The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We have main engine start. Four, three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday Morning Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. It's great to be here. Thank you all for joining us and tuning in. Let me run through the announcements and on to our program. For those of you who would like to call and participate, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners. Please let the phone ring until it can be answered, and then we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And for those of you at work, and when you tell me you can't use the phone lines, we understand that. Therefore, email is available for you. It is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download our programs. They are compressed MP3s. A 90-minute show is about 40 megabytes. And you're free to distribute and share and pass these around and put them on a DVD or however you want to get them out to your friends to help people understand why space is valuable and important to us all. If you do have any questions about that, just get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Also, do remember not to do anything commercial with the programs. Don't edit them. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if you're using them for your own personal use. And then private YouTube channels and things of that nature are not permitted either. And we do podcast. We thank Andrew, and he's over at gigadial.net. He does do our podcasting. You can find our RSS URL on our website and both of our newsletters. And then we're also in iTunes with our podcast, Microsoft Zune, astrospacenow.com, wyastro.com, Podcast Alley, and a host of other places. If you have any podcasting questions for us, please do let us hear from you. And again, the email address is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do check out our website, thespaceshow.com. Remember, we have a very comprehensive newsletter on our homepage. You can't miss it. And it has all of the details of the week's programming, the guest bio, and it's also the only place where you will find a future events section. And then if we have to change our schedule for some reason or get an announcement out to you, you're going to find it first on the website newsletter. So do check it from time to time to stay current. You can also subscribe to the very short email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning, California time. And it just has one or two lines about the week's programming. And if you'd like to receive that newsletter, please send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we have done since the beginning in 2001 is available on our website. You can easily listen to it just off of our website, or you can also download the programs. We have a store at the top of our website. It says Space Show Gear. Please do visit it. And then you'll see the support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation.org, and our program only exists because of your generosity. We thank those of you who do support us, and all the rest of you should be thanking those who support us too, because it's because of them that you get the Space Show. So we do thank them and appreciate what they're doing. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you get a tax donation at the federal level. If you're also a California taxpayer, you get a California tax donation, as we are a California public benefit corporation. And then finally, do remember that we are partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. And you can get much more information about this fine organization by visiting their website, secureworldfoundation.org. I have one final announcement. I know many of you will likely be attending the New Space Conference, which is going to be in Santa Clara, that's Santa Clara, California, July 26th through the 28th. Well, today is the end of the early bird registration for the conference, as well as for all of the events, the meals, the banquet. And I believe the price is up tomorrow, and it's between 20 and 30%. So if you are intending to go to the New Space Conference 2012, July 26th to 28th, it's at the Hyatt in Santa Clara, you need to register today rather than wait and then pay the higher fee. So think about it if you're intending to go. So today we have two guests with us, so I'd like to welcome back our friend Dr. Madhu Thangalevu. And Professor Thangalevu is with the Department of Astronautical Engineering within the Viterbi School of Engineering at USC in Los Angeles. He's also a graduate thesis advisor and a lecturer for a graduate seminar in extreme environment habitat design, which is part of the USC Architectural School. And he has been doing a space exploration architectures concept and synthesis studio in the astronautical engineering department there as well. And also he is a space projects director for the Cal Earth Institute, which is in Hesperia, California. He's an advisory board member for the Los Angeles section of AIAA, a creative consultant to aerospace, a fabulous professor, and a great friend of the space show. His full bio is up on the website, so you can read about that rather than my talking about him. We are joined by one of his recent graduates. Frankie Sharp is a lead accredited architect in Los Angeles. He recently got his Master of Architecture from USC, graduating in May of this year. He studied in the Moon Studio under the direction of Professor Thangalevu and others, and he focused personal research and design on the future of lunar tourism, and we're going to be talking about that with both of our guests. He has his Bachelor of Arts in Architecture from Clemson, and he studied at the University, I'm going to screw this one up, Politencia de Catalunya in Barcelona, Spain. He's been an intern architect with other groups in South Carolina as well as Los Angeles. And it's a pleasure to welcome Professor Thangalevu and Frankie Sharp to the space show. How are you, gents? How is everything going? Madhu, you're in the Bay Area now, right?
Yes, I am. We have a nice sun here in Palo Alto. How are things in Tiburon?
It's a beautiful day in Northern California, and hopefully wherever everybody else is, it's also nice. And Frankie, you're in L.A. What's it like down there?
It's a little cloudy out right now, a little chilly this morning, but the last couple of days it's been like that and kind of burned off and gotten pretty nice in the afternoon, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed for now.
Okay, listeners, so you've now got the California weather report. Professor, give us the studio report now. What's going on with your most recent class in your environmental, harsh design, strange architectural class? And I know you like to focus on the moon and other great habitat designs. Tell us what this course is all about.
Well, David.
Yes.
So now, once in a while, the School of Architecture at USC will get enough students to host a studio, and this time around we had some wonderful faculty who got a bunch of very creative students together to propose a moon studio. And this happened partially because NASA gave us a pretty prestigious award for a connected project through what's called the NIAC. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am familiar
right.
with that.
And so when that happened, this was a joint effort by the School of Engineering, that is the Department of Astronautical Engineering, the only one of its kind in the universe, near the cosmos. You heard that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and the School of Architecture. So when that happened, Dean Ma, who is the dean of the School of Architecture, got folks together and said, hey, it's high time to run a moon studio and see how it works. So Professors Carlson and Leach came on board and did all the bureaucratic stuff needed to make it happen. And so we ended up with 10 students in a graduate studio that looked at various creative possibilities that we could use and do in the near term on the moon, or perhaps not only in the near term, but you know, in different times. And you know, I always believe that architects have a handle on certain programmatic issues, and of course, they are unparalleled in visual capabilities, in graphics. And so they put all this together, and lo and behold, we had a wonderful session that Frankie will tell us about. Now, there were several ideas that came out in the spring, and you know, when we talked, David, I thought the one that we should present today to our listeners is the idea that Frankie Sharp put together. And that's why we are so happy to have Frankie with us. Frankie, would you like to say a little bit about yourself and tell us what is it that got you to want to do something about returning people to the moon, and what did you do?
Sure. Yeah. Well. Thanks again for having me. Obviously, this was as an architect and as a studying architecture, this was quite a new venture, I guess, for most of us, but really turned out to be really interesting and a great time. Basically, the way the semester was set up was that the students would have to kind of research the moon. Most of us have varying, I guess, levels of background research and knowledge on the moon environment and exactly what it would be like to design some sort of structure up there. So that's how the semester began, and it was up to us as the semester went along to figure out what would interest us and what we thought the moon could use in terms of future development, or you know, not necessarily sending people there, but if it was some kind of mining or research or what have you, just whatever interested us and what we thought could be of value to the future on the moon. So as the semester went along, I really got into thinking about some of the Apollo missions and people wanting to go back and see those. I know that SpaceX has already started talking about having a lunar orbit mission that typical civilians could pay to take part in. So that idea of being able to go back and explore the moon and see it up close was really interesting and intriguing to me. And then obviously all the factors that would go into that really kind of pointed the direction of my project. So I don't know if we want to get into specifically what the project was right now or
sure. What was your project about?
So after kind of going through some of the research, a couple of the factors that I found was that NASA's already established some guidelines for visiting the Apollo missions. Obviously, with the lunar environment, there's no wind, no rain, just some radiation and I guess meteorites. So the footprints that Neil Armstrong put on the moon are still there. All of the artifacts, everything has basically remained untouched. And in order to keep it that way, NASA set up a buffer zone of about 250 feet around Apollo 11 and 740 feet around Apollo 17 that basically keeps people away from, and robots, rovers, whatever, keeps everything away from those missions to kind of keep them intact and remain, keep the artifacts there for as long as possible.
Why a different boundary for the two missions?
Well, at Apollo 11, obviously it was a very small mission. At Apollo 17, they actually had a rover, so they were able to explore much more of the surface and get a little bit further away from the landing site. at Apollo 11. If you look at a map of it, it was a very, very small area that they walked around on. I think about the size of a baseball infield is what it's compared to a lot of times. So that gives you a rough idea of the size of it, as opposed to Apollo 17, where they had a rover and were able to drive, I think, maybe over a mile away from the actual site. So the equipment and some of the artifacts are spread out in varied degrees. But at Apollo 11, where man first set foot on the moon, and at Apollo 17, where the last person to leave the moon, those two actually have ground buffer zones. The rest of the Apollo sites, and then also some of the Ranger sites, have no landing, no fly zones. So at the Apollo sites, there's a 1.2-mile buffer radius, no fly zone, no landing zone, to make sure that, ejecta from rockets, or if there was some kind of crash or, I guess, emergency landing that needed to take place, it would make sure that all the artifacts were kept under safe control. That was, I guess, one of the first and biggest guidelines. That obviously has a lot of physical implications with the design of it. Another big factor that we looked at was the movement of the sun across the moon's surface. On Earth, obviously an Earth day is 24 hours, so you have sunlight for about half of that time. And if you were on the moon, a lunar day is about 20, Madhu can give me the exact date, I think, 26 days.
70, approximately,
Yeah. So I calculated out what the movement of that horizon line, the termination line, would be across the moon's surface, which comes out to about 10.5 miles an hour, or 250 miles per Earth day. So if you were going to be on the moon and you wanted to remain in a consistent temperature with consistent shadows, as you worked your way across geographically the surface of the moon, you'd probably want to move about 250 miles every Earth day. So what that does is it starts to lay out more or less a coordinate system of where you can hit certain artifact sites, certain Apollo missions, but also give yourself a good speed to move across and kind of lay out the entire mission itself as you're doing that. And then I think the probably most important is radiation. That was one of the big factors that everybody had to deal with. Without an environment on the moon, without an atmosphere on the moon, there's a lot of radiation, a lot of cosmic rays and solar flares that are pretty unpredictable, but just cause consistent radiation damage to anything that's on the surface. So you'd have to be very careful sending civilians up to the moon with limited protection for a week or so. So that was kind of a factor if you needed to put them underground, or if you could build some kind of above-ground system that would maintain a high quality or high level of radiation protection. But that was really, I guess, the few factors in my project that really kind of guided it and where it ended up today. So what I came up with was a system of hopping from site to site using a maglev mass driving launching and landing system. Some of these things that might be a little futuristic, I guess, that we were thinking, in 50 years from now, if they actually implemented this system, we would have a better understanding of how these things work. But for now, the thought process was that you could launch and land using a mass driving system, which requires less energy and also would limit the amount of, rocket ejecta that's required for taking off and landing near these sites. And you would launch hop from site to site, seeing each of the Apollo missions or whatever was set up on your guideline, whether it's some of the international landing sites for, satellites or what have you. And at each one of the sites, there would be a vertical tunnel that could have accommodations inside of it. You're underground, you're protected from radiation. And then at the top of the tunnel, the tunnel, there would be a system that elevates out of the ground to give you kind of a view of the site, get some background information. And I called it ELVIS, so Elevated Lunar Viewing and Information System.
That name.
And basically it just gives you, it would give you a background. You would have kind of a command center, if you will, where you get a nice view of the site. You could put stuff up on the screen that shows you what exactly happened, happened at each particular site, how it all went down before you were able to go back down to the surface and then walk around and explore it if that was allowed, which wouldn't be allowed at Apollo 17 or Apollo 11.
But. Now you have pictures of this. Are listeners able to access these pictures?
Yeah. There's a couple ways to do that. I have a personal website that's just frankiesharp.com, and I have some of my projects up from school on there. But there's also a blog that we set up for the studio that has a lot of the other students' work as well, and that is uscmoonstudio.blogspot.com. And if you go to that website, my project, I think, is one of the first ones that's listed on there. So there's a lot of images and some of the research for my personal project, but also some of the other students, what their final projects were, and also some of our background research projects from earlier in the semester.
Does it identify it as your project or this other person's project? They can tell?
Right, yeah. My project is just called Tour of the Moon, so each project has its own, list of slides that you can click on and then scroll through each individual project. So if you were to go to the Moon Studio blog or to my personal website, there's a separate, I guess, list of slides that for each different project that you can scroll through.
Okay, so I'm looking at the PowerPoint that Madhu sent me, and I'm looking at slide 25. So this thing that sort of maybe reminds me of the Seattle Space Needle, is that
right.
How you get to the underground tunnel?
Right. Well, that's actually the Elvis system. So that would be essentially the cap, if you will, on a tunnel that goes vertically underground. And what the idea was is that everything needs to be, or it's better if it's underground just for radiation protection.
Uh-huh.
So if you can imagine a tunneling system that's more on a slope, about a 15-degree slope that starts maybe 200 feet underneath the surface and slowly works its way out, and then at the tip of that is the launching and landing zone. So you would almost like a spacecraft on Earth would kind of fly in and land on an incline or I guess come down on an incline. You could imagine a hopper kind of coming in and being received on one of these maglev systems to slow the system down with a mass driver so that it actually docks underneath the surface, allowing for the civilians or the people that are viewing the sites to be underground for the most amount of time possible. And then when it's time to come up and view the site and see some of the artifacts, that Elvis would actually come up out of the ground and provide sort of a viewing platform to get a better background of the site and some information and before you go out and walk around and see it.
So you have a lander over to the left and then this gondola car with the SpaceX on it. That's the maglev hopper.
That picture was designed for Apollo 11 and Apollo 17. So the idea for that was, since you're not allowed to walk inside that 250 foot buffer zone, if there was an actual gondola that could attach to just at Apollo 17 and Apollo 11 for this specific purpose of being able to get really up close and see, you know, Neil Armstrong's footprints and see some of the artifacts that are there without walking on the surface inside of the 250-foot buffer zone. So that was kind of a separate idea than the overall, mission function. It was specifically for the Apollo 11 site and the Apollo 17 site where there was that buffer zone.
Okay, so doesn't someone have to walk on the site in order to build the gondola and all of this stuff?
I would think that you could probably try and hang the wires from side to side. Obviously, that would be an issue that a little further down the road would need some more looking into. But for this purpose, it was just a way to express being able to get up close to the artifacts without setting foot for each new visitor, without setting foot on that buffer zone.
And the people all, the tourists get spacesuits, I guess, and are capable of doing a spacewalk at the other sites?
That would be the idea. I would, like I said, my background is in architecture, so I'm not 100% sure what that whole process is for training and being able to use a spacesuit, if you would be able to do that, if it would be a feasible option. But my thought process was that if you were going to go all the way to the moon and you wanted to see these sites and you were going from site to site, it would be unfortunate to not be able to go up to the site where you're allowed to walk around and do some surface exploration. So that was my reasoning behind it. I would think that would be a huge draw, and obviously if you're there and it's a possibility, it would certainly be warranted to kind of walk around and explore.
I did bring that up, David.
Yes.
During earlier talks with Frankie, and you know, architects have a sensitivity, David, and it kind of revolves around keeping people happy during a holiday, a vacation. And I think Frankie, in the back of his mind, was trying to play it safe. You know, he wanted people to go to the moon, relive the experience, because I think he mentioned to you that as the as the gondola moves across, you'd be able to see holographic projections of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin coming down the Apollo 11 Eagle lander and stepping out and taking that first step on the moon, exactly on top of the real first step that is there. And these are technologies we have today. So I can tell you what will happen in the next 30 or 40 years that Frankie plans to see this happen. But I thought this was very, very cool.
Now, slide 27 shows them getting into an elevator on the surface, so that's how you get underground?
Right, yeah. When Elvis is on the surface, or I guess the majority of it is underground, but there would be a way that you could come out to the surface to a permanent shelter garage where a lunar rover or what have you would be docked, and then also the spacesuits would also be kept in storage there. So you could come up underground without having to pull Elvis out of the ground, and then load into the spacesuits, get on the rover, and then go from there and explore.
Cool designs of the spaceship and everything. Listeners, you'll have to go check this out when we put the URL up for you to go visit this when you're listening to this program. Any idea, that does your class at all try to estimate what something like this would cost, or is it all more a design idea rather than trying to really see if it's doable or cost what it would cost?
A lot. Madu has a lot better idea of what it would cost. I know that there were some figures given to us of the amount of, or the price that it cost just to get a kilogram of mass to the moon, and so much pricing, and it's pretty expensive. But I know that. I know that just looking at how much it costs to go to the International Space System space station starting in 2001, I think they paid $20 million, and then the most recent trip was in 2009. It was around $35 million. And I believe that for some of the private missions where they want to do lunar orbits are being projected now around $150 million. So obviously, there's a lot of money that it would cost just for an individual to take part in this, but to develop the system and build it, it would be just because you'd have to get these materials to the moon for some of the actual construction would be pretty pricey.
Since NASA was sort of a sponsor in this, do they take your designs and do anything with them, or what happens after the class ends, or does the class just end and that's it?
Well, let me bring that up. I think maybe Frankie is not so aware of what our plans are.
Okay.
But usually, at the end of a studio like this, either in the School of Architecture or in the School of Engineering, we put together some of these abstracts together into a manuscript, and I enjoy presenting them, hopefully with the students, at the AIAA Space Series of Conferences, which happens in our backyard, you know. I think I've seen you there several times.
Oh, yeah, and this year it's in
Pasadena.
Yeah, near the ballpark, yeah, Pasadena,
that's right.
Right.
So, you know, we are hoping that we will present an interesting manuscript. Hope Frankie will present it. The paper has been accepted, so I hope you will come and be in that session.
Well, I will be at the conference.
Okay.
So, yeah, absolutely. We'll have to make sure I flag it, because, you know, what they do is they give you 5 million tracks to follow with 6 million sessions,
okay.
And, you know, it's almost impossible to find what you want.
That's right.
You know, and they're spread out over a big area at the Pasadena Center, so... Is the girl in the spaceship going to be there?
Oh, that's just Frankie.
Or is that a figment of your imagination, Frankie?
I'm not sure if she'll be present or not. I can do some more background research.
Is this real or robotic or fantasy?
The idea was that I think that the slide you're referring to is what Madhu had mentioned earlier. So that would be a projection kind of hologram. Of the Apollo site happening, or the Apollo mission happening before your eyes, and maybe we could get some kind of operator hologram in there as well to keep people company.
So these are just
200 tickets, Frank.
So these are the tourists that are in there watching the holographic projection, right?
Correct. Right.
Okay, and so I see. So it's actually kind of a heads up display because you're looking at the screen, so the astronaut in the red box is coming down and reenacting and stepping in the footsteps of Neil or Buzz.
Right. One of the ideas that we talked about through the semester was along the lines of what Disney does with some of their rides, and I guess it's called the Disney Imagineering, where there's a lot of augmented reality that's happening today, where you put up a projection or set up some kind of hologram that reenacts something that happened, and it would give, I guess, the viewer a better understanding of how the mission happened and what exactly the astronauts did there, how certain artifacts got to certain places, what the purpose of having a camera over on this point was as opposed to, you know, setting up the digging instrument over at this point. So it was more an idea of augmenting the reality of being able to see those astronauts land on the moon again, walk around, see their mission, and exactly what they did.
You know, David, that was the thing that caught me, and you know, I went like, wow, you know, who wouldn't want to relive the Apollo 11 landing on site? And, you know, we have those technologies now, and you can only expect it to get even better in the coming years.
Now,
and Frankie showed us that idea. I said, hey, it's time to show this to the world, because do you remember Blastoff Corporation's idea to go back to the moon and do similar things with robots?
Sure. Yeah, a long time ago. Uh-huh.
That's right. And so here the big difference is, hey, take away all those robots that don't mean anything, and we're going to put real people there and, you know, let them suffer through this or enjoy this. and I thought that was a fresh new angle, and as architects can do.
Now, you had quite a few celebrity attendees and judges, and wasn't Buzz one of the judges?
Oh, well, you're mixing it up. You know, Buzz came to our engineering studio finals, which we'll talk about momentarily. But we had some good people. Harvey Wickman was there. Ed Mekaloff was there. Several people from JPL came. So we had a good crowd of people. Usually, in our studios, we always have more reviewers than students, and that's a good thing, don't you think?
Yeah, depending on how they review. So, and you you know, I was across town at the Responsive Space Conference. As it turned out, I should have come to yours.
I sent you an invite.
Yeah, I should have come to yours instead of staying at the Responsive Space Conference. But
yeah, there were lots of things happening that week in the Southland, and there was also that Space Expo that was happening.
That was the big draw. Yeah, that apparently drew everything and even took away from the Responsive Space Conference.
Is that right? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the attendance was different from previous years, but
yeah, well, when I dropped in, this was the last day of that expo. It wasn't very crowded, hey, but there was good lunch there, you know.
No, well, yeah, but the couple of days before they had major presentations by ATK on liberty and some other things.
Yeah,
and my understanding is that those press conferences and things are pretty well attended.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, so and I know that in looking for interviews with some of the companies at Responsive Space, they told me all their personnel was really over at the expo, and I should go over there. But you know, that's a drive across town in L.A., and it, you know, I'm used to L.A. traffic, I'm not that excited about it.
Well, when I went in there, because it was close to the venue where we were presenting, you know, USC Architecture School, it does a lot of things differently. Their presentations happen in parallel, and so we have 300 or 400 students gathering to present their ideas in a very large venue in downtown, kind of like the convention center, but perhaps.
Oh, so you're not on your campus?
Not on campus. These are new things that our wonderful Dean Ma has instituted in the school about how to handle large groups of presentations at the same time. And, oh, David, you should have been there to see the creativity of architects.
Well, in hindsight, I agree with you. But I, as you know, I thought I was going to be at Responsive Space and do all the interviews and everything else, and I found out everyone was over at the expo.
Oh, okay.
So what can I say? So you had other projects besides Frankie's, correct?
Yes, we did. And there were several beautiful graphics that you will see in the rest of the slides I've put up there. There are two or three in particular that are very, very interesting. One looked at how to use certain tools that are available to the architects to evaluate the terrain of the polar regions, to pick out spots that are safe for lunar landers and for habitation and so on. And I thought Lily Kerrigan was in charge of that. She did a very nice presentation on how you go about the logic of getting to that. And I think you'll see all those slides in the URL that Frankie will give you, I suppose. And then there was one about how we might use robotic structures to build up colonies. And, you know, there was this fascination with swarms and so on and so forth. And so there was some absolutely glorious graphics that were presented on how to build lunar habitat and what they might look like. And coming from architects, they have a very different feel about what it means to go to a place that is you know, heavenly. That's like paradise. I mean they keep all the hardware and stuff in the background and spend their time honing how to attract your client to a beautiful place. And I hope the International Space Station designers and so on, you know, employ more architects to get their job done.
Well, they certainly employ space architects, but the ones that I've talked to, not too many of them talk about beauty and aesthetics. They're mostly focusing in on utility and functional design and things like that.
And these are not new things. I mean, it goes to the dawn of the space age. You know, when Korolev was designing Sputnik. I mean, he was busy telling his guys, hey, listen, polish this thing up so good, it's going to be shining like a star. And I mean, starting from the start of the space age, I mean, the space aesthetic. I think that was part also of the faculty's intention to see if we can explore new forms. They call it form finding, and you know, some interesting things came out of it all, David.
You have a question from John, who is in Los Angeles, and he says, do you have to be an enrolled student at USC to be involved in this class? Or if you're an architect...
You take your money, and it is important to be enrolled if you want to get credit.
He says he's an architect in L.A. and wants to know if he can just take the class.
Oh, well, I mean, I've had several queries like this, particularly from the engineering studio. You know, the way a school operates is that you get credit only when you go through the process of registering and paying for tuition is the first important thing, because hey,
I know about the tuition.
You know?
What were you going to say about the tuition, Frankie?
Just that I'm fully aware that they are taking your money if you're trying to take the class. There definitely is a price. I'm fully aware of that one.
Are you going to do it again next year, or do you have to have, you said earlier, you have to have a certain number of students willing to do it, right?
No, that's a good question, David. Yes, I did talk with Dean Ma, and he's excited about conducting this space architecture studio in the spring. So we can expect to see an even more more exciting studio now that we have done one. I think it's coming.
Kind of like in the actor's studio, but this is in the architect studio for space, right?
That's right. You know, David, I think you know this, but the mechanics of a studio, the reason we call it a studio, is different from a sit-in seminar or a lecture. And some of the things have to do with how you inspire the participants. Now, Frankie will tell you that, you know, we had no less than 8 or 9 visiting lecturers come in and show what they did. I mean, we had people beaming in from a University of Arizona showing the insights of the the agricultural unit that they are building there, the lunar greenhouse. We had John Spencer come in and talk about space architecture. We had Bruce Cordell come and talk about the philosophy of things and why they are about to happen. Several others, JPLers, came in and talked about Mars and so on. So all these things rub into the different participants in ways that are difficult to really pin down till the products appear. Frankie, did that help you at all, some of these talks?
Absolutely they helped. As an architect, as somebody that, my background knowledge of the moon was basically limited to what I learned probably in high school and in middle school, and not much more after that as an undergrad. So having these talks and talking with some of the leading researchers and professors and so forth in the field was really instrumental in everybody kind of figuring out what their interest was and things that people were already doing in the field and how that could, I guess, affect your own design and further direct and pinpoint where you wanted to research. So it was very informational. Every one of the talks, even if it didn't necessarily have anything to do with my personal research, was, I thought, a great experience.
Frankie, you did your architectural training at Clemson, and then you went off and studied in Spain. Was there any mention of or any application or anything you did there? Were there even any classes available relating to space?
No, that's what really intrigued me about this this semester. I didn't know what to expect. Everything that we've done up to this point, or everything that I've participated in up to this point, has always been an Earth-based project. Not necessarily in a specific location. It might be a made-up site or a site in the middle of nowhere that, you know, is remote and you can't really get to, so you don't know what the exact factors are, but nothing off of Earth. Everything's kind of always been Earth-based, and nothing really space-related. So that's whenever we found out, we had every semester you get a list of the studios that are going to be coming up and the topics that you have to pick from. And just being able to use my last semester and focus on the moon and in that environment and that program was really, really interesting. And I'm really glad that USC decided to allow us to do that.
So you didn't apply for and attend grad school at USC with space in mind. You just discovered it because of the moon studio.
Right. Yeah. You know, for most of the master's students, I think that graduate school gives you an opportunity to figure out what you're interested in. There's a wide range of projects. I think in the four semesters that I was here, we did a school. We designed a sports stadium. We've done and then the moon and also like an apartment complex. And so I mean, you get such a wide range of project topics and programs that it really helps you figure out what specifically you want to go into once you graduate and once you have that master's degree. And basically are put out into the real world. So I did not know what exactly USC was going to be offering, but the wide range of projects was really unbelievable. It was great.
You got a question, excuse me, either of you. Karen says, I'm planning to study architecture at Cal. I'm wondering, do you at all do any of the engineering in the projects you've talked about, both your moon project as well as your terrestrial project, like a sports stadium, or are you only focused on design work?
You know, in this moon studio, we had a faculty involvement from both the School of Architecture and the School of Engineering. So yes, indeed, we have one-on-one contact in both the structural mechanics and various engineering aspects, and so it is definitely a collaborative environment, David. And I think we talked about this years ago when we said that, you know, education is not what it used to be in terms of separate disciplines anymore. More and more, the participants who come in already hold degrees, and they already know some subject or the other. And education is now more interdisciplinary than it ever was. And I think it's a good thing because, you know, that's where the creativity of students shine because, you know, they say, hey, listen, I didn't know this angle to the picture, but now I can import this into my discipline and explore. And that is what is happening at the university levels, at least in the national universities like USC.
Gentlemen, we're halfway into the show. Let's pause, and we'll take a three-minute break, and we'll be back with more of your comments and questions and more from our two guests. And again, our phone number for those of you who are able to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223, and we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, We will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Friday Space Show, and we have been talking about the innovative architectural studio that Madhu has at USC, and recent graduate student Frankie Sharp in his lunar tourism project. Madhu, are you? Why are you up in the Bay Area? Are you teaching up here? What brought you to the Bay Area from Los Angeles?
Well, Catherine had been commuting here to work at Loral for the past year.
Uh-huh.
And then we decided we'd move up because, the flying schedule was getting to her. And so now I decided I'll fly down for the coming short term. And so it's working that way for now. And we are exploring Palo Alto, which is a very interesting little town. You know, everybody bikes. You know that, right?
Yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, and
so that's why we are here.
If you go over to Mountain View and to Google, they all bike too. So.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everybody is on the street, and most importantly, you don't have to drive the kids to school anymore. They ride their bikes. You know, and so. So they have their own freedom of movement, which is good.
Yeah, it's very different from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Totally. So now do you have a list of projects or ideas or things that you, have sent me? And one of them is something we talk about on the Space Show from time to time, and we also expand it. You mentioned creating a U.S. Department of Space. But we've also talked to people who think we need to have an equivalent of the Civil Air Patrol for space, the Space Air Patrol or something of that nature, and maybe it fits hand in hand with a Department of Space. Do you really think that would be beneficial if space were elevated to a cabinet level?
Well, Dave, let me bring you up to speed on what happened in the engineering space concept studio since our last talk. I think it was 2 years ago.
Okay.
And we've been trying to connect up. I know how desperate we've been on both sides trying to find the right time, but never happening. So in 2010, we extended our 2009 ideas about the International Space Station. And several bright ideas came about, which you will see in papers. And then, in the last studio, we were thinking, what would the team project be? And as usual, it's the student's choice. They look up the literature and come up and elect to do a team project. And this happened to be about the Department of Space. They got on some things that was discussed and it keeps coming up again and again. And they zoomed in on this idea that, so many projects are waiting in the wing to be executed, but somehow they are not happening at the national level. Maybe there is some kind of a structural change that is needed to make these projects come to fruition. And one angle which they put out is to say, hey, listen, maybe it is time for the United States of America to really get into space in a meaningful and a very, very commercially oriented manner, because we have the infrastructure lying around since the last 50 years, and we have done some incredibly, magical projects, the most recent one being the International Space Station. And it is a struggle. It is a tremendous struggle to build models for international cooperation, where everybody wants to have a sizable portion and a good part to play in global projects. I want to define what a global project is, David.
Okay.
a global project is something that impacts all people. All people everywhere. And, you know, I can't think of anything more global than a planetary defense or orbital debris mitigation or, you know, those kinds of things where, you know, pollution and climate change monitoring. I mean, these are global phenomena. And we have to transcend the idea of us versus them to execute these projects. We cannot use a national model of prestige and, how to get our beefsteak somehow and grab it and run. We can't do that, at least not in global projects. And for global projects, I think it's so open, the territory is so open for the United States of America, not for other nations, to be able to participate, to lead, to shepherd, and say, listen, we are going to build a planetary defense system. And I'm telling you this because other nations have tried. They've tried to do this, but it's not worked because all of them, including the emerging, and flourishing economies on the other side of the world, they've tried to bring people together, but it has never happened. It just doesn't congeal. And I think because the U.S. has experience in international space station, partnership and so on, they should take this to the next level. And it really, really has to happen with commerce at the middle of it all. Because, you know, hey, commerce is the lifeblood of all civilizations, whether you like it or not. You know, you can only engineer governance and so on so long. But to really get to action, you got to have 100 companies like Elon Musk. And that is what we would love to see. And what would it take to do that? Can NASA do that? Again, it's a question. I mean, if you look at the history of NASA, I mean, I can't believe the times they walked over nascent private enterprises in space, left and right, just because they thought, you know, it was invading their turf. Or, you know, it was affecting some of the programs that they already had in incubation and so on. But in my opinion, if the president really wants to, I think this president has been thinking about it, you know, re-architecting the cabinet. And so the students are very quick to say, hey, listen, it's probably time to put in a solid Department of Space. That really articulates both global vision to take charge and to help other countries move up the ladder and do wonderful things like planetary defense and orbital mitigation. I can't think of any other nation doing this.
What do you think the likely chances are that something like this would happen?
Well, I think a paradigm shift has to happen both within the government and, in people's needs that, you know, we are moving into a 21st century economy. And even stemming from the U.S. Constitution and the freedom of man, space beckons. I mean, space is telling you, hey, here it is. You know, you fly, you put a man or a woman, into a spaceship, and you inject them into orbit. 8 minutes into flight, you shatter all the notions of Machiavellian politics of the 20th century. You can't handle people flying in orbit by saying, hey, he belongs to us, he belongs to them. Astronauts will tell you, you know, the moment they look down on planet Earth, all ideas of us versus them just vanish, just evaporate. And so there is a dogmatic problem, and that is, can we use the policies of old to orchestrate that to make things happen in the 21st century. And my feeling is it's futile. You can't do that. You know, you've got to restructure the way we think about humanity as a common species. Do you know that philosophy is called cosmopolitanism?
No, what? Tell us what that is.
Well, let me tell you. Portis recently awarded a medal to somebody at Princeton. You know, and I did not know about. Of course, I know what cosmopolitan is.
Right.
But this whole philosophy hangs around the idea that yes, we respect people for what they are, wherever they are, and we share common values, and we love their differences. We are not interested in imposing structures way of life on other people in the world. We enjoy the diversity. And at the same time, you help them grow more vibrant. And if you look at the history of the philosophy, it goes down back to the Greeks. And so I think space is the ultimate, not weapon, but tool for promoting cosmopolitanism. And I think the time has come in the 21st century, you know. I mean, people are getting sick and tired of war in, you know, chasing after resources and so on. I think the time is right to rethink the way we govern, the way we do business. And space is a key. Space development, not just, you know, that's the other thing. Everybody associates space with space exploration. I mean, it's a very tiny part of space activities, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I don't think enough people, you know, think about space as a solution set for the ills of the world or anything else.
I know that. I mean, that is an area where we need to perhaps bite the bullet. But, you know, I think space has a way of inspiring, and space has a way, in terms of evolution of technology and the core technologies that are involved in human space activities. We are right at the threshold right now to be able to do things that we could only dream of, just 20, 30 years ago. Just think about it. A warehouse in Los Angeles is able to challenge and execute missions privately that took nations to orchestrate and organize in the past. And this is just the beginning, because hot on the heels of SpaceX are several other companies wanting to do the same. And so we are faced with this fact. I mean, it's not fiction anymore. There are several companies around that are getting ready to fly missions. And I don't think NASA or the FAA by themselves will be able to handle all the coordination that is needed to make all these things happen, which really is, promoting a new kind of technology in the 21st century, you know. And I'm hopeful that it will somehow creep upon everybody. Hey, listen, it's time to change the way we think about the us versus them attitude. It's about prosperity for all. There is so much to do, and space can play a role.
Let me ask you this. Have you talked to anyone outside of the space community with any of these ideas? Does it seem to grab them and at least get their ear? Or I know that people in the space community would be supportive. What happens when you take it outside this community?
Well, of course, I keep talking about it. And, but mainly in the space community. But you're right. I have not really engaged government officials in this matter. But I think it should dawn on them. And the way I saw the light on this one is because students brought it up. I mean, you know, in the team project. And I like to say this because I think I sent you the URL for the slide set with Buzz Aldrin presiding. You know, when they first approached me and said, "Hey, listen, how about a Department of Space as a team project?" Yours truly got a shock. And he said, "Oh, that's right. That's right. All we need is a Department of Space to say that we want to put pressure on the whole wide world with an extended overreaching arm of the Department of Defense or the U.S. Department of State or something like that." And, you know, I took it in, and then in any case, I said, "Listen, go and show me something that you think is about the Department of Space, right?" And so I put out a little symbol. I borrowed the Department of Space emblem, and I rewrote on top of it Department of Space and floated it into the class and said, "What do you think? Is this what you're thinking about?" 2 days later, Dave, 2 days later, I got an emblem. I think you'll see it in the stuff that I sent you. I got an emblem back. It did not have the eagle in it. It did not have the arrows or the laurels in it. Instead, right down the middle was a beautiful planet Earth. And it said, U.S. Department of Space. And then I took that in and asked him to put it alongside the rest of the department. And that alone told me, "Hey, listen, here is the new generation. They're coming up fast and furious on us." No, no pun intended, okay?
Hopefully not, yes.
And they see the world in a different way, David. They really do. You know, for instance, take the term complexity. You know, we deal with complex systems in space activity every day.
Correct.
I mean, these are very complex systems that go up into orbit, and you got to keep maintaining them and so on, monitoring them. But just that term means differently for the new generation of people who handle much more information on a routine basis than we are used to. So when they say, "Hey, we don't care, we can do multi-engine systems operating under different parameters all simultaneously," you're going like, "Oh my goodness, you know, if only you knew the history of this thing." But you know what? They not only think these things, but they make these things and do them. So my own opinion is the time has come for the elders, for the old guard to slowly hand the reins over to our wonderful new generation of students who can handle this in very gracious ways and still make it work, you know, in terms of space-based systems.
So you want to sort of pass the torch?
In many ways, so, because see, if you look at the reports, if you look at the reports that came out in the past 2 or 3 years, you know, there was one from MIT, I think you recall that, right?
Right.
The Future of Human Spaceflight. Oh, written by the elders of the space program. They know exactly where we should go. You know, they want to extend the International Space Station model, bring China and India on board, and keep space totally under government control and do very big projects. You know, I'm not against it. I don't feel that way at all. I feel that, yes, we should do it. But how much of this should be done by the private space sector? How much of it should be done by small business? I think, you know, information technologies are so ahead of what we think it is, that very complex projects can be handled by small groups of people you know, planted all over the world and executing projects. So then there was another study recently from Caltech. You know, the asteroidal retrieval study, right?
Yeah, we've talked about that a lot on air.
That's right. I mean that kind of tells you, you know, that the private sector wants to really get into the picture, and you know, I applaud them for it. And all these things are happening simultaneously, and you know, can one agency that is already ingrained in a way of thinking handle these new things? Well, I don't know, David.
I don't think NASA can do it. I honestly don't. I don't think they're equipped to do it.
What does Frankie think? Frankie is listening in, right?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, what do you think of the elders of space, as Madhu calls us?
Well, like we were talking about earlier, just the background information that I think a lot of, especially for this studio, a lot of us architecture students didn't have, the wealth of knowledge and the plethora of knowledge that we used through them was really exciting and helpful, and I guess maybe our naivety that from some of the factors that we just didn't think about constantly that maybe the elders do allowed us to look at it from a different angle. So I think that there's I guess good sides and bad sides to both the older generation and the younger generation getting into space exploration, and then just the future of space colonization and stuff like I did with tourism. There's just different angles to look at it and different approaches. And you know, having engineers and aerospace engineers and architects and different backgrounds and different generations, it's just it's helpful. You know, it's not a bad thing. It's always going to be a good thing to have a new set of eyes and a different approach.
You know, my take on this, Madhu, is because I get to talk to everybody, you know, the elders, the codgers, the geezers, and the young dreamers, okay? And so the wealth of knowledge across the board is definitely with the elders to a very, very large degree. They know this stuff. They know the challenges ahead. They are realistic about the economics and the costs and the markets and the human factors challenges, you know, the medical side of things, the engineering, the physical side, the propulsion. And the younger groups are probably not as well steeped in the basics, but they're much more vision oriented, and they often think that the elders, to use your term, Madhu, are negative because they, when they talk about the challenges, and I'm certainly guilty of this big time, it comes off to them as we're being negative. We're preventing the mission from even getting underway. We're throwing up all sorts of roadblocks. So on the one hand, they are at least aware of these arguments and the issues. And on the other hand, there's a strong tendency, especially with the space enthusiast, to disavow them and to think that those of us who talk about human factors or closed-loop life support systems or something like that are too extreme. And then there's the group that's actually working in the field, the people like at SpaceX and Bigelow, for example, that I've had the opportunities to meet. So they are understanding more and more of the challenges and the physics and the engineering and the realities, and they don't discount them like the enthusiasts do, but they see how to use that information and how to keep moving forward more so than the older people. So, and I think that's because they have an easier time grasping a future and solutions than people who have struggled with this all their life and know the facts and the details, and they've never seen progress, you know, because we still don't have a variable gravity research station, for example. You know, the people Frankie's age had nothing to do with that. That's our generation, Madhu, that never put that together to find out what G-forces humans can live with and flourish in deep space missions. But we've all heard it talked about for 30 and 40 years, right? So our group knows the issues and the challenges, and we don't know solutions. And the people working, like at SpaceX, you mentioned, or Dream Chaser over at Sierra Nevada and so forth, they know this stuff, but they also believe that they can actually create solutions where we didn't. And the enthusiasts tend to just think that all of this is too extreme, and we're just trying to be negative by throwing up human factors or bone loss issues or this or that. So I've kind of divided it into three areas. But I think you're exactly right. If you're looking for a lot of progress and moving forward, you're not going to get it from our generation.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I remember, I think it was Jerry Purnell who in one of our talks, he brought up the term pranging. Do you know what that means?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, let me tell you something. It's something that we do as children. It is something we vigorously pursue in progressive astronautics. That is, you make something physical, a physical artifact, an engineering artifact, and you take it to the extreme and you let it fail. I mean, we do it in all of engineering, not just astronautical engineering. And it is only by failing and failing and failing again that you really produce new creative things. And now, you know, if you did that in the government enterprise today, the cost would be exorbitant. I mean, it's unbelievable that you would test half a dozen different types of engines and then get one that flies well. But you know what? The problem is that things cost too much money to make. Is it because material costs too much? I really doubt it anymore because, you know, at some point in time, I think already it is out there, we know what things cost to make and fly. And this will definitely change the way governments operate, agencies operate. And NASA too will have some serious lessons to learn here. You know,
I was just sent a group of papers from a fifth grade class in the Midwest, and they wanted me to be one of the reviewers of these kids' papers. So they're 10 years old or so, and two sets of papers supported space exploration. One set of papers did not support space exploration. But the interesting thing is, two of them addressed failure, and both sets of papers, which means one supporting space and one not supporting space, said that failure was a real problem and a real detriment to continuing to move forward because so much of this stuff fails, and then it's a waste of money and on and on and on. So in my comments to both of these students, which ran about to both of these groups, which ran about 3 or 4 pages each, probably half of that was to change their perception on failure. And I use Google as an example, where they absolutely encourage failure. And the only time you fail is if you don't learn any lessons from it or if you don't ever try anything in the first place.
Absolutely.
But every entrepreneur, everybody knows that you go through cycles of failure to be able to learn how to do something.
Yeah. And I think it's a very important part. You know, I sometimes think about this, David. I mean, you know, in our culture here in the United States of America, we applaud success after success after success.
Right.
And we look badly at people who fail. And then you probe the people who succeed. You really see that they are very, very very tough and resilient. They do fail from time to time, but they don't advertise it, you know. And I think you were talking about the baseball game day before. I didn't see it, but after you sent me that email, I was at Pete's Coffee here, and I opened the sports page.
And there it is.
It was, you know, Cain, Abel, and I was like, whoa, yeah, Dave was really on top of his game there, you know.
Well, right, and the thing is that I don't know how many years he's been pitching. It's like 5 years in the major leagues or something, but the headlines are mediocre pitcher. I mean, Cain has had years where he has struggled and been a pretty, you know, mediocre at best, maybe rotten pitcher.
Yeah.
This year, he's been really exceptional, and the guy pitches a perfect game. There's only been 22 of them in the entire baseball history. So does that come from years of struggle and failing and being mediocre and trying to figure out what to do? And everything just happened, you know, correctly with the team and everything to be able to do it. But because you fail doesn't mean you're a failure.
That's exactly right. I think all kids, we would expect all kids to go play ball or some game or the other so that they realize that it's not about winning as much as it is about performing. And
learning from how you perform.
Absolutely. You know, and I fully agree with you there. I think Frankie has some ideas. Frankie, do you play any games?
I grew up playing pretty much any sport that was available to me. I think my mom just liked to get us out of the house. So if it was organized sport and it was within a 5-minute car ride, I was probably signed up for it.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there you go. So you know that you might have a bad year or a bad season, but that doesn't define you as the player unless you quit.
Well, yeah, and specifically relating it back to what we were talking about with the different generations and such, I think that using sports and using some of these, I guess, life lessons, so to speak, and then being able to come into a project like this, that's just for us. It was so new and I guess unresearched for the architects that it was a lot of trial and error, a lot of failures, and I guess a lot of just kind of whatever you had in mind, something that interested you, and trying to put it on paper or get it into a computer system or build a model and then have Madhu tell us, where the problems might be relating to space, but being able to refine it each and every time and work our way down to what we had as a final project was new because, you know, we didn't have these factors before. So usually in architecture, you have a similar process, but being able to relate it to a whole new field and a whole new design process was really interesting.
Madhu, you talk about in one of the lists you sent me, space and spirituality. I do an ongoing series and have almost since the space show started called Our Spiritual Connection to Space, and I usually do between 2 and 3 programs a year that are focused on that particular topic. What do you mean by space and spirituality?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, David. But before I get into that, let me quickly run through a couple of other papers that are coming out in our space conference. This last engineering studio that Buzz attended, several new ideas came up, David, and one of which is the idea of a suborbital space transportation agency that handles, you know, suborbital flights that is coming of age right now. And another one, which is very creative, David, is the idea of producing nuclear fuel in orbit, not here on Earth orbit, but at the Lagrangian point. And this is a very clever idea we'll be presenting, which says, hey, listen, we know that we can't fly nuclear materials out easily because of, you know, the problems with launch, but we can take fertile material and nucleate them in places way outside. And you'll see that idea coming up. And then there was another idea that talked about how to make hydrogen from algae in orbit. And yet another one dealing with, everybody talks about fuel in orbit.
Right.
And they always think of going places with it. But the equation also says, if you look carefully, that you can put it to good use for coming back from orbit. If you fill up your vehicle in orbit, you can use it to fly down at much, much saner velocities and make your vehicle's design much, much more interesting. And there was a very interesting one, which also will be presented at the space conference as a poster, and he calls it the Lunar Supercomputer. Have you ever heard of something like that?
No.
The idea is to put a large supercomputer complex at the polar region and somehow hook it up with the aging deep space network so that we have a new evolutionary capability for communications with planet Earth, and we can continue to evolve this on the moon over a period of time, and we thought it's a very intriguing idea. So anyhow, those are the papers that you'll be seeing when you come to the space conference this time around.
The one in Pasadena?
Yeah.
So this will be at the Space 2012.
That's right.
Are they poster sessions, or is it a presentation where the students present their stuff?
Well, there's one presentation, and the rest are posters, because you know we try to get the participants to do most of the work, and you know they're making some very nice posters. David, you'll be pleased to see them.
Okay.
So which brings me to space and spirituality, David. Now. First of all, I've been asked, after I wrote that piece for CNN, people, I enjoy reading the comments that happen more than, you know, anything else. And there are comments like, oh, there he goes again, another religious zealot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going like, wait a minute, you got to reread this thing so that everybody gets it clear. We are not talking about my God versus your God kind of stuff here. We live in the 21st century now. You know, and there are certain things about nature that we have absolutely no clue of. And this should not come as a surprise because you know, in my opinion, 95 to 99% of the workings of the universe still remain hidden from us. And, you know, we can either be... we can either be overconfident about what we know or something like that, or we can continue in our scientific process and learn things as they come, which is what I think good scientists do. You know, they walk around the riddles of the mysteries of the universe and hopefully seek answers. And it is in that respect that I bring the term spirituality into the picture. I think it was Albert Einstein who said, you know, he was asked if he was religious. And he said, of course he is religious. He knows there are a lot of things that are absolutely mysterious. And that you know, when it's revealed to you, the feeling of mystery, that is really part of spirituality. You're going like, wow, can this be true of nature? I mean, it's not only true. These things are real. And so, I mean spirituality in that respect, David. The ability to stand up to nature revealing herself in ways unknown. And, at the heart of it is space exploration, because a space explorer, every time he or she is injected into a new environment, completely starts to change from the inside out or from the outside in whatever way it is. Because they experience the sheer power of nature. And this comes down, it is not a hypothesis anymore. All you need to ask is crew returning from various missions. In particular, the Apollo missions, because they were able to see planet Earth from quite a distance, you know. And if you look at the logs and the things they were saying, they delve in the scriptures they go back and try to encompass the feeling, and it is always a spiritual experience, David.
Kind of like some of the things that Stephen Hawking has said.
I wouldn't say that, because I know, Stephen Hawking is definitely a scientist, but his angle is definitely important to pursue, which brings me to the thought, you will be interviewing Lord Rees on Sunday, and did you know that he won the last Templeton Prize?
No, I did not know that.
Oh, gosh, you better quiz him about this. Because do you know what the Templeton Prize is, David?
Tell us about it.
Okay, now, see, John Templeton made his money elsewhere, and he put up a foundation to study the connections or the coherent patterns that exists between religion and science.
Well, that's what his new book is about, in a
way.
That's
right. That's right. I mean, these are things that he had been working on. I mean, Martin Rees had been working on this for a while. And anyhow, the Templeton Prize is valued more than, purse money-wise, is more than the Nobel now. And of course, scientists who delve in religious thought have a shot at winning the Templeton Prize. Paul Davies is a winner. There are several people from the U.S. who have won this prize. And it's about seeking connection and seeing that, all of human thought is coherent. All of human thinking, spans a variety of philosophies, but they all have some commonalities. And, I think it's Leo Tolstoy who said that, the mind spans from one end, which is pure mathematics, all the way to theology on the other end, And you can't dismiss one or the other. It's all a broad spectrum of thought. And I think spirituality is with us whether we like it or not. If you listen to hard-edged philosophy, sometimes Stephen Hawking comes across as, we do not need this idea of God in the picture. We can do this with the numbers that we have. And you hear this again and again from several other people practicing hard science. And I'm sure we will come to a time when we know a lot more, the workings of the universe. But until then, I think it's healthy to have spirituality connected with life and living.
Do you know Lord Rees personally? Have you met him?
I have exchanged some emails with him in the past, and I don't know if he remembers, but you may want to quiz him. He's a very interesting man. My brother, who is in Cambridge, sat in a panel with him not too long ago. So I know that Martin has a varied interest in all things scientific. My brother is interested in traditional forms of medicine.
Uh-huh.
And... So I think they sat together at a panel that talked about the health of humanity, and he brought up some. Martin brought up some very interesting ideas. He said that one of the things that he said was that if people thought in their own language, as in their own inherited or other tongue. They would bring more original ideas and results to science than if they did using a language that was not their own, and that intrigued me, So he has a lot of interesting things that he mentions. He has a wide range of a very wide range in which he engages. And there is another person in Cambridge too, whom he may like to get on board at some point in time in these matters. His name is Brian Josephson. I think you know the Nobel Prize winner.
Right. Well, I don't know him, but I know who you're talking about.
They are all in the same group, discussing a lot of things.
We're a little over the time slot, why don't we summarize? So, Frankie, do you have any concluding thoughts? Anything you'd like to leave with listeners today?
Just to summarize, I think that I wasn't very aware with what's the current status of space design and exploration, and that it really seems like a promising field, and that there's a lot of very interesting designs and developments that are happening as we speak, and a lot of really, really interesting projects that are going to be coming out soon. So I'm just excited about it as an architect, as somebody that probably wouldn't have had the opportunity had it not been for school presenting the design proposal to me. So I'm just excited about it and look forward to seeing what's coming out, and appreciate Madhu and Neil and Anders giving us the opportunity.
Madhu, any concluding comments from you?
I think thank you, Frankie. I know it was a pleasure working with you, and those middle of the night, very early in the morning emails asking, now I'm stuck, what do I do?
Yeah.
That's how designs progress. And in terms of the overall picture, David, my thinking is we really have to think of new ways to conduct our space business. A lot of us tend to trash the current administration, but I like to think that as I mentioned, when the world has so many priorities that need attention, space tends to fall behind. But that should not worry either the practicing professional or the people who govern, because I always like to think that good ideas have a way of reconstituting themselves to present at the right opportunity.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
I thought I lost
David,
you. Then.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk with and to see the things that you do.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I look forward to seeing you in Pasadena in a couple of months. And, Frankie, perhaps you'll be able to come over there, too, if you're still in L.A.
Yeah, definitely. Always interested in seeing some of the future design developments. So, most certainly looking forward to any opportunities.
Okay.
Very good. Happy Father's Day to all.
And to you too, and to all the fathers out there and listeners. That's it for today. And Sunday, Sir Martin Rees is on our show. He's a member of the House of Lords, an esteemed scientist, as all of you know. We're talking about his new book, which is listed in the newsletter, so you can check that out. And we're looking forward to talking to him. So thank you again to Madhu and Frankie for a great space show. Everybody have a great weekend, a great Father's Day, and back Sunday, 12 noon, California time. Thank you all, and goodbye from the space show.